You turn to Marketplace for the latest news about what's happening in the economy and how it affects you and your community. When you donate to support our nonprofit newsroom, you can also get something a little more tangible. We have a great lineup of donor thank you gifts right now. A shrinkflation mini tote bag, water bottles, mugs, hats, and a lot more. Contribute any amount to make a difference and pick up one of these gifts. Go to marketplace.org/donate. Welcome to a Marketplace Morning Report special, as we explore multiple forces, especially economic forces, shaping migration. Our title is Barriers to Entry, the Cost of Crossing the Southern Border. I'm David Brancaccio. Here's one episode surveying our coverage, about a half hour of your time. People move toward prosperity and away from the opposite. Many economies in Central and South America have lagged the world in recovering from pandemic. The World Bank recently directed $5 billion to help. William Maloney is chief economist for Latin America and the Caribbean at the World Bank. Thank you for joining us.
Pleasure to be here.
Now, as the world faces inflation, interest rates have moved higher, and that's not helping Latin America, but it's not helping really anywhere in the world. Why is Latin America lagging during this post-pandemic phase?
In the medium term, there are about four things that drive Latin American growth. One is exactly what you just mentioned, which is interest rates, which are plateauing a bit right now. But commodity prices enter, and they've been falling. Growth in the G7 is critical, and that's been rather slow. And then growth in China is really uncertain. And all those things in the short run dictate that Latin American growth is going to be rather slow. The bigger concern for us is that over the longer term, we have these slow growth rates as well. So this suggests we have deeper structural problems that we need to work on.
By the way, there's an irony, right, that you mentioned in the earlier part of your answer. So worried about inflation, but actually some commodity prices, for instance, oil, has not been as high as it was. And for countries that produce commodities for sale elsewhere, that becomes a problem.
Absolutely. There are basically two groups of countries in the region, those that export raw materials, and they suffer a bit when commodity prices fall, and then those that import food and import petroleum, for instance, the Caribbean, and they suffer a lot.
Any thoughts, given your understanding of the situation, about low-hanging fruit that might help the region jumpstart economic development?
In the short term, there could be more active, for instance, foreign direct investment, slightly harder, or just reducing the barriers to trade. If you compare the cost of trading across borders in Latin America, it's about four times what it is in the OECD. Working to reduce those costs, developing what we call deep trade agreements, where there's more harmonization of rules of trade on either sides of borders, can really help to facilitate trade and make foreign direct investors be more open to using Latin America as a trade platform.
It's hard to talk about immigration without thinking about the economic context in the places where people are coming from.
Absolutely. And we've done work in the past showing that, for instance, areas where American firms set up in Mexico saw a decrease in migration as a result. So we've long had this idea that if we could help Mexico grow faster or Latin America grow faster, there would be less migration here. And there's evidence that that does happen. So that remains a good strategy.
World Bank's chief economist for Latin America and the Caribbean, William Maloney, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now to Colombia, which almost a decade ago was the fastest growing economy in South America, but is now struggling with inflation and more people coming in from Venezuela. Catherine Ellis is with our newsroom partner, the BBC.
More than 7 million people have left Venezuela since 2015. Well over a third of them have settled in Colombia. But like these new arrivals near the border city of Cúcuta, many who've made homes here are heading to the U.S.
At least there is a possibility of changing your life. Here in Colombia, you earn money, but it's not enough to support your family.
We're making only enough to eat, nothing more.
Food, rent, and transport have all got much more expensive since the end of the COVID-19 pandemic. And it's not only Venezuelans who are leaving. Colombian taxi driver Robert Ojeda says many of his colleagues are already in the U.S. I ask him if he's also thought about going.
A lot, because I've seen those that have left are doing well. After the pandemic, everything here got more expensive. This month, the fuel price rose, the cost of living, the rent, nothing goes down.
2 years ago, the World Bank started giving billions of dollars worth of loans to Colombia to help kickstart the economic recovery. Alejandra Botero is an economist who is director of Colombia's National Planning Department and in charge of implementing the World Bank loans.
It was very important for the economic recovery, especially with small, medium, informal economies, how you could be able to very quickly get the pre-pandemic growth that we needed.
Colombia's economy grew at around 7.5% last year, more than double the regional average. The World Bank also injected cash for the government's policy of allowing Venezuelans to apply for the right to work legally in Colombia.
You can also get incorporated into the health services. You can open a bank account. After a few years, the returns are very high in terms of GDP. The economic result of successfully incorporating migrants into a country is very, very big.
And the policy has stopped some people from leaving. At a busy marketplace in Colombia's capital, Bogota, Venezuelan César Pinar says Colombia and the right to legally work here has been a lifeline for him.
For me, it's still a cup of gold that needs to be looked after. Look at my case. I'm an engineer working in a fruit shop. What I earn here, I couldn't earn in Venezuela as an engineer. I can send money to my daughter.
While some Venezuelans and Colombians continue to leave, for many like César, who don't want to chase the American dream, the Colombian one is now within their reach. In Colombia, I'm the BBC's Catherine Ellis for Marketplace.
Social media has transformed the illegal business of transporting people seeking better lives. Marketplace's Elizabeth Troval reports on how a popular direct messaging app has greased the wheels for the multi-billion dollar human smuggling business.
I first met Pedro in a northern Colombian migrant camp where he was guiding Haitians, Cubans, and Venezuelans through the forbidding forested hills of the Darien Gap towards the Panamanian border at $100 a person.
Hello.
2 years later, we catch up over a WhatsApp call. I'm using the pseudonym Pedro to protect his identity because he himself has come to the U.S. and has a pending deportation case. He says when it comes to migration, WhatsApp is the platform to make it happen.
Para la inmigración, pues, excelente porque es que...
It's encrypted, free, anonymous messaging and works even as you cross borders. No international phone plan necessary. Before his trips to the Panamanian border, Pedro would connect with soon-to-arrive migrants on WhatsApp. He'd have motorcycles or horse-drawn carts ready to get them to camp and let them know costs ahead of time. Most of the thousands of dollars collected each day from migrants ultimately went to the Clan del Golfo, a powerful drug trafficking and paramilitary group. Pedro's WhatsApp number would get passed from migrant to migrant. Then, on Pedro's own journey to the U.S., he coordinated with a coyote in Mexico who sent him names and meetup points on WhatsApp. TikTok and Facebook have also been used in smuggling, but more as a way to advertise services, says Nilda Garcia with Texas A&M International University. She sees coyotes offering trips on Facebook groups.
A lot of people responding, asking for their services, asking for more information.
Guadalupe Correa Cabrera with George Mason University says Facebook and TikTok is where misinformation spreads, especially during immigration policy changes, and that could push a migrant to reach out to a smuggler.
I would contact someone who can provide me a more clandestine form to enter the United States or a faster form to do it.
They may turn to friends or family for a recommendation. And once they have a number...
WhatsApp is the way to connect the smuggler with the client.
The platform gives the smuggler anonymity, reduces costs, and has standardized their customer communication. I'm Elizabeth Troval for Marketplace.
Now, let's turn to a Homeland Security investigator who warns about the dangers for often teenage Americans enticed with offers of money to smuggle people and contraband. Craig Larrabee is Special Agent in Charge at Homeland Security Investigations San Antonio. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
I'm trying to understand this. This is like an informal gig economy thing. People using social media are being offered money to provide what kind of illegal service?
Well, there's all kinds of things that happen, obviously, on social media. The one that we're concerned about recently, really here, is the use of social media to recruit young kids, high school age, to do human smuggling, particularly picking up migrants in different parts of the South Texas and bringing them to other locations. What we've seen is that recruitment going through social media goes to a lot of our larger cities. Historically, the recruitment was local. Now, social media expands that ability to recruit.
So a teenager could be on, say, TikTok or Snapchat, and it'll say, you want to make some easy money or something?
Whatever particular social media there is, yes. Now, they're being recruited, quick money, come down here, pick up some folks, drive them somewhere else, and collect thousands of dollars. Now, the problem with that is they're going into locations, particularly along our border, which are rural, which are ranches. They're being told to evade law enforcement. So it's entering very dangerous situations.
See, I was thinking you're going to tell me something like they're looking for truck drivers with commercial licenses and straight trucks with no windows. This is just teenagers with a car.
Correct. Now, people, once they're smuggled across the river, they're put in stash houses where they wait for a period of time, and then they're usually or historically moved into tractor trailers. So that's when you're talking about the recruitment of the tractor trailer drivers. Now, those are CDL drivers are going to drive the vehicles and try to bypass checkpoints in the tractor trailer. Obviously, one of the most dangerous situations we can have, particularly in South Texas with the heat here. Now, if we're talking about Eagle Pass and Del Rio, those are usually smaller vehicles, maybe box trucks, but a lot of small cars. Normally, that should be three or four people in a car, but trust me, they get a lot more in some of those cars because they'll pay per each migrant. So they want to maximize those profits.
So what are approaches, policy approaches for dealing with this?
From an HSI, we're the criminal investigator side of things. So we investigate the organizations behind it. What we've seen is, you know, continue to do those investigations, try to take out the organizations at a larger scale. That's our primary focus. But we'd be amiss if we're not doing what we're doing here today. And we actually have social media campaigns that we're trying to push out to our local schools. We're going to work towards driving schools, things like that, where we can get this information out. Because again, teenagers think they're invincible. They think nothing's ever going to happen to them. But time and time again, we can show them examples of when things do not go well.
Craig Larrabee, investigator with Immigration and Customs Enforcement, thank you very much for the time.
Thank you very much for having me, and thank you for letting me speak to this issue.
Now, for those waiting for courts to decide their U.S. immigration status, there's a move toward less detention and toward more electronic monitoring. This means money for private companies doing the tracking.
Electronic monitoring has been a boon to GEO Group, the second largest private prison company in the country, says IBIS World analyst Alex Petridis.
Just a year ago, it was 12% of company revenue, and now it's over 20%.
GEO Group has a $2.2 billion contract with ICE to handle the agency's electronic monitoring of hundreds of thousands of people. Danny is one of them. He asked us not to use his last name for fear ICE would retaliate.
Yo usé ese grillete aproximadamente 3 años.
He wore a monitor on his left ankle for 3 years and spent another 2 being tracked by a smartphone app. He left Honduras after gangs targeted his businesses. While waiting for his asylum case, he felt like somehow he was the criminal. Parents wouldn't let their kids play with his daughter.
Mi hija recibió mucho bullying.
His ankle monitor battery would last fewer and fewer hours. He remembers one night at 3 a.m. waking up to a frantic call from GEO Group after his battery died.
¿Dónde está? ¿Dónde está? ¿Dónde está?
Calls like this grew more frequent. Then his lawyer helped him get a seemingly less intrusive option, a monitoring app called BI SmartLink. It was just as stressful. He didn't trust that the app on his phone wasn't spying on him, and he got frustrated with the app failing over and over. So how exactly does it work? On a Zoom call, Houston ICE officer Edward Caney pulled up the electronic monitoring dashboard with a map showing where someone was at different times of the day.
This individual here woke up this morning and went straight to work, and he's currently still at work.
The BI SmartLink app also reminds people about important events like court dates. Former INS Commissioner Doris Meissner, now with the Migration Policy Institute.
It's providing migrants themselves with accurate information, a process that can be very confusing.
Electronic monitoring can improve the likelihood someone shows up to their court dates. But advocates aren't convinced. They say having a lawyer or case manager is just as effective, and that doesn't involve a deportation agency. I'm Elizabeth Trovall for Marketplace.
Returning now to the forces that push people to leave home and to migrate, let's visit South America's second largest economy, Argentina. Inflation there is running at about 100%. There are higher fuel and food prices, in part due to the Russia-Ukraine war. Pandemic distortions, drought, and political instability are also at play. And more people in Argentina want out. The BBC's Natalio Cossoy reports from Buenos Aires.
Being able to afford rent, saving, and in some cases buying basic goods has become particularly hard in Argentina.
It is difficult, and especially in the last couple of years with the rises in inflation rates.
This is Ivan Castro. He is 28 years old and he's a neurology resident at this private hospital in the capital of Argentina, Buenos Aires. Medical residents make the equivalent of around $500 a month.
Do you know how much someone working a similar job in the US or Canada would be making?
Yes, I've been in Canada recently. A resident would be winning maybe between $3,000 to $4,000 Canadian dollars, way, way more than what a resident here.
In part due to the economic situation, Ivan has decided he will move to Canada.
It's getting more difficult to grow and to be stable here.
More people are leaving or thinking about leaving Argentina. Inflation is making life hard, and it's not just 10 or 12% a year, it's more than 100. Economist Micaela Fernández Alaua works at think tank Fundar. She says people are caught in a vicious cycle.
Because we've reached a high inflation regime, everyone adjusts their expectations and their behavior according to the inflation in the previous periods.
In essence, everyone assumes prices will go up, so acts defensively, raising their own prices. Gabriel is the manager of a dairy products and cooked meat stall in this food market in Buenos Aires. He says the cost of food is constantly changing.
We use this kind of sticker to display the prices, and then we switch to magnets because it's easier when you have to change them all the time.
His income has dropped so much that Gabriel has been forced to move out of his home.
The rent was too expensive. It doubled from one month to the next.
People like Gabriel are the ones who lose out, says economist Micaela Fernández Alaua.
People cannot update their income as inflation rises.
That's driving some to leave Argentina to try to find a better life. For those that stay, their only hope is that the general election next October will bring some desperately needed economic change. In Buenos Aires, I'm the BBC's Natalio Cossoy for Marketplace.
Moving now from Argentina to neighboring Chile, where immigration flows are taking a new course. Chile has long been a destination for South American migrants, but now the government there has applied new restrictions. The BBC's Jane Chambers reports from Santiago.
26-year-old Angelo, who didn't want to give his full name, sells fruit and vegetables at the local market. He came to Chile 6 years ago from Venezuela to escape the political and economic situation there.
I chose Chile because it was stable and there were good jobs prospects. I came as a tourist with my passport and stayed.
His friend Elias, who also wants to remain anonymous because he came to the country illegally, arrived recently and had a much tougher time getting in.
It took me 15 days to get to Chile by bus. I went through Colombia, Ecuador, Peru, and Bolivia. I slept in different bus terminals, and it was hard, but I couldn't come by plane because I got to Chile illegally and I didn't have the paperwork to come by plane.
He says once he got there, he struggled to get work, but did eventually find a job. There are now almost 1.5 million immigrants in Chile, according to the Chilean National Institute of Statistics. Recently, huge numbers arrived from Venezuela and Haiti. Chile's president, Gabriel Boric, wants to stop migrants from illegally getting into the country. The military are now helping police and border control officers to patrol the region. The government says it's necessary to stop the rising crime, some of which it blames on migrants. That's affected many Chileans' attitudes towards settled migrants like Angelo.
We know that a lot of people with criminal records have come to Chile from Venezuela and give us a bad name. But we are not all like that. Most of us wanted to come and earn an honest living and help the economy.
Beatriz Siguel, a specialist on migratory patterns at the University of Chile, believes the resentment is also to do with rising inflation.
There's this huge idea that migrants came here to take Chilean people jobs, that it's not true. Migrant people actually get jobs that Chilean people doesn't want to do.
Angelo says Chile has now lost its allure for some migrants.
I have family who've decided to go to the United States, but it's very hard because they have to do it illegally. They tell me about walking through jungles, accident and people dying, all to get to the United States, which is the dream for people in Latin America.
He says those who have made it say it's worth it. With little sign of inflation or crime falling and ever-tightening border controls, many more migrants are now following, turning north away from Chile and setting their sights firmly on the US. In Santiago, I'm the BBC's Jane Chambers for Marketplace.
One subset of migration are refugees leaving parts of South and Central America seeking asylum in the U.S., and refugees despite U.N. rules for those moving away from feared persecution, violence, or war. So many are waiting and waiting at the U.S. southern border. Isabel Gil Everett is a researcher at the College of Mexico in Mexico City who studied this. Welcome.
Hello, David.
Let's talk about what some might describe with the word being in limbo. You see U.S. and Mexican policies as contributing to a prolonged state of people being displaced and not quite sure of their future?
Yes. So my colleagues, Claudia Masferrer, Oscar Rodriguez, and I have been working on this subject for a while now. And there's a term, I guess, coined by the UNHCR around 2004, that's called protracted displacement. And we found that concept to be extremely useful to understand what's going on in the border between Mexico and the U.S. And it refers to precisely what you were saying, this state of limbo where you are not able to plan your next day. You don't know what's going to happen with your life or the life of your family members in the following weeks or months. You can't decide to enroll in school. You can't get a job. It's hard to get a house. So all your life is sort of like very unstable because you're not able to know what's going to happen.
And this can have, obviously, emotional costs. It can have economic costs. It can have costs in terms of forfeited education. I mean, just across the board.
Yes, definitely. And that means that people are living in shelters. They don't have a permanent address where they can get mail. They can't have a bank account. So some of them can't even get a job. They have no legal documentation in many instances. So people are just waiting and waiting without being able to get on with their lives.
What's your sense as a researcher who studied this? Is this uncertainty built into the policy to discourage people from trying, or is it just bureaucracy that compounds on itself, you know, government inefficiency?
I mean, I think it's fair to say that it's a mix of both. The asylum system in Mexico gets like 1/100th of the budget of the migration enforcement authorities. They don't have enough resources to process the amount of asylum requests. And I think something similar might be happening in the U.S. But it's also hard not to think that there's sort of a deterrence objective motivating these policies? Like if you are told you have to wait for a week, even if it's in hard conditions, but you're guaranteed that in a week you get an answer, then you'll wait. But if they tell you it's a week and then it's a month and then it's a year and then it might be forever, some people might actually be discouraged and just drop their cases because they can't survive. Maybe that will be a deterrent for them and for others coming behind them.
Isabel Gil Everett is a researcher at El Colegio de Mexico, the College of Mexico, and co-author of a paper on migration policy in the Journal of Migration and Human Security. Thank you very much for the briefing.
Thank you very much, David.
Now to a workplace issue in the U.S. that can affect native-born workers, but can affect immigrant workers disproportionately. There are predatory employers who steal from worker paychecks by withholding wages or benefits. It's wages that add up to billions of dollars every year. Getting the money due can be complicated if it works at all. Back to Elizabeth Trovall again on a digital platform designed to help.
42-year-old Hermes Diaz knows how it feels to be taken for a ride. Do you know what it's like to work all day from 6 a.m. with no coffee or lunch break, he says, and not be able to afford the train home because your boss didn't pay you? That happened after a contractor didn't pay him for a construction job in 2015. Years after filing a Department of Labor complaint, he is still owed thousands of dollars, even after the contractor was asked to pay up. But he still got some money. New York-based advocacy group Make the Road had him fill out a ton of paperwork. Now, a new online tool aims to streamline the process.
It's helping the worker understand their rights to figure out how much money is owed.
Rodrigo Camarena created the app called Reclamo with nonprofit incubator Justicia Lab. It's kind of like TurboTax, but for people to get back stolen wages.
It's going to help them file a New York State Department of Labor wage complaint form. And it's also going to help them write a letter to their employer as well as a demand script.
Demand scripts are among the most effective ways to get back stolen wages. Camarena reads from a sample one.
And it says, "Hello, Joe. This is Rodrigo with the Immigration Advocates Network, and I'm calling about the work conducted by Juan at your business. According to our records and the labor law requirements, you owe Juan an estimated $17,770 for liquidated damages, unpaid wages, overtime fines."
The call script is populated by the data entered in the platform, like about days worked, wages earned. And it's meant to help workers who can't afford an attorney.
What we're trying to do with this platform is empower the thousands of people that are already helping immigrants that maybe aren't lawyers, but with the right training, with the right support, can do a lot of the work that we now pay private attorneys for.
Make the Road community organizer Rodman Serrano in Long Island has filed a couple claims through Reclamo.
It's been simplified and a huge time saver. And I think it also just kind of makes folks feel a little bit more like encouraged.
It builds confidence in the legal system when half the battle is getting people to file complaints in the first place. I'm Elizabeth Trovall for Marketplace.
We've been looking at how economic forces are shaping immigration. It's been 37 years since the last sweeping immigration reform was passed by the U.S. Congress. President Ronald Reagan signed that one into law back in 1986. There's pressure from conservatives and liberals now for new approaches to immigration, but bipartisan efforts to take this on have consistently fizzled. We'll be covering new attempts and new ideas that seek to bring order to that process as we move into this new presidential election cycle. Our program, Barriers to Entry, was produced by Marketplace's Ariana Rosas and the BBC's Joe Critcher, with help from Alex Schroeder and Erica Soderstrom. Our digital producer is Jordan Manji. Our senior producer is Meredith Gerritsen-Morby. And our executive producer is Kelly Silvera. Audio engineers are Drew Jostad, Nick Esposito, Brian Allison, and Jessen Dueler. The general manager of Marketplace is Neil Scarborough. I'm David Brancaccio. And this is from APM, American Public Media.
Hey everyone, it's Rima Jerez, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.